morning session. We're very happy to have Ivan Aguirre from Louisiana State University, and he will talk about LQC, non-Gaussianity, and CMD anomalies.
So thank you, Ivan, for the invitation, the organization, and giving me the chance to speak here. So this talk is
a kind of extension.
Microphone on.
Now it's on.
So let me start. Thank you for the organizer. So this is a kind of extension of Abai's talk. You know, Abai was talking about loop quantum cosmology, but he was addressing more foundational issues. You know, what are the basic principles behind this theory? What are the mathematical basics of the theory? And even so, he was answering from the list of questions. He was answering some of them. I want to focus on a different question, which is what are the observational consequences. So this talk is more about phenomenology than about the mathematical aspects of the theory itself. And what I'm going to say is work done in collaboration with different people during a few years, and also some work in progress. So the motivation comes from Abai's talk. Just very quickly, let me just summarize it. So Abai explained to us that what LQC is a mini superspace version of loop quantum cosmology. The underlying principles are non-perturbative and background-independent quantization of gravity. There are nice mathematical techniques. One is able to get a Hilbert space of states that satisfy the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, in which a massless scalar field is introduced and interpreted as a time. And because one has a Hilbert space with inner product, one can ask physical questions. And among the most important consequences is that there are no singularities in the Hilbert space. There is no state in which Dirac observables diverge, so the Big Bang is absent. And also, if one does evolution with this internal time, one sees that there is always an instant in which the state goes through a minimum volume, a maximum curvature, so the Big Bang singularity is replaced by a bounce.
Wait, what are the assumptions?
Say it again.
What are the assumptions? What models are you considering?
Yeah, especially flat Freeman Robertson Walker.
What kind of mattering? Is it only the free massless scalar or other matter? You're just saying
this
energy density, so you're not really saying what kind of matter you have.
I said a scalar field as a matter. I mean, this is just what Abbas said. You know,
well, that's your time. Is there any additional matter?
No, that's the only matter we have.
Okay.
So just to gain, but you know, I don't want to go into the theory because my talk is about observations, and as I will argue, this is much more general. So
now you have a potential.
So here I have a potential.
So that's not the same setting.
I mean, it's a kind of natural extension of the same setting.
But you don't have the same analytical and numerical results in this case.
So to gain intuition about what this theory is, one can focus on a small set of states which are sharply peaked, so the quantum dispersion is very small, and they are useful because for them the quantum gravitational field can be, is very well described by a smooth metric, a smooth Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric that satisfies this set of what people call effective equations of LQC, where these new corrections to GR appear, and this new correction makes that, you know, that whenever energy density is comparable to this maximum value of the energy density, which is a fraction of the Planck scale, rho gets maximum and h goes to zero, and that is a quantum bounce. So what I want to ask in this talk is what are the consequences of this approach? And I want you to keep in mind two points. First of all, that, you know, I will use the basics of loop quantum cosmology to do concrete calculations, because I need a framework to do concrete calculations. But all what I want to say of the consequences are more general. If you give me a different bounce with a slightly different properties, the results will go through. So, you know, keep your mind open. This is just phenomenology of a bounce happening in the early universe. And as we saw in Ed's talk, there are many other scenarios, like, you know, group field theory, or even these Mukhanov and collaborators, scalar tensor vector theories, in which some similar equations appear. So all what I'm going to say goes through to those scenarios. So, and the way I want to do phenomenology is that I will use the bounce to complete inflation rather than to replace it. So inflation will still be in my setting, and the bounce will happen before inflation. And my motivation to use a bounce before inflation comes from Robert's talk. This is a very similar plot to what he wrote. You know, he showed us on Monday time vertically, length horizontally, physical length. Inflation starts here, onset of inflation. This is the end of inflation. Two scales. The red curve is the Hubble radius, which is constant during inflation. The blue scale is the physical wavelength of a Fourier mode of a perturbation, let's say a scalar perturbation. Initially sub-Hubble, inflation takes it super-Hubble, and particle creation happens there, and inflation creates the primordial spectrum. But we don't know what happens before inflation, we don't know how inflation starts, and you know, the picture, the whole picture is incomplete. And just copying, quoting Robert, you know, the open questions are what is the scalar field coming from, and what is the potential coming from? What are the initial conditions of inflation? You know, normally one assumes that inflation starts at some time and perturbations are in the vacuum and then computes consequences. But of course, the consequences depend on the initial state. So if we don't know what happens before, what is this assumption coming from? I mean, why the binds the vacuum or not something else? If inflation is too long, we enter into transplantian issues with the modes. There is a singularity in the scenario. We may be pushing GR too far, etc., etc. So what I want to do is to use this cosmological scenario to answer some of these questions. Of course, you know, if you are talking about quantum cosmology, the applicability of GR, singularity, transplantian problem, they are answered by definition of the theory. You are doing quantum cosmology. And so my goal will be try to compute what are the initial conditions of inflation rather than assume them. You're having something happening before inflation and compute and see how inflation arises, how inflation appears, and what are the initial conditions. The only thing I cannot answer is what is the origin of this scalar field and what is the potential. So at this point, I don't have anything else to say. So in my talk, I will assume that there is a scalar field and an inflationary potential. And you know, I fully support the sentence by Robert. So first, the first thing I have to answer is if inflation is compatible with a bounce at all. In the sense that, is inflation generic enough if you have a bounce? So inflation is going to appear generically enough in the presence of a bounce? And this was a question that Abai addressed with David Sloan long ago. So I mean, not too long, but a few years ago. So I want just to go fast over this. And the message is that the attractor mechanism that inflation has in GR is still present if you have a bounce. In the sense that if you go to the bounds and you give me initial data for the inflaton field and the velocity, most of the initial data, almost all of the initial data, will give rise to a phase of inflation later on with more than 60 e-folds. So the answer is yes. In general, inflation is generic if you have a scalar field and a potential, of course.
Is the scalar field also quantized now?
I mean, this is just what people do in cosmology. You can think about the zero mode of an inhomogeneous scalar field. You can think about the expectation value of the zero mode if you want. So you can think about that as a quantum field if you want. But it's homogeneous.
How you combine new quantum cosmology with the scalar field?
It's homogeneous scalar field.
So this is the zero mode. The background of the scalar classically.
Exactly. Is the zero mode of the scalar field.
This is different only about the bounds.
He's asking if it's classical or quantum.
I'm asking if the scalar is classical or quantum, yes. So the scalar is classical and you add small quantum fluctuations.
Yeah, the perturbations are
going
to be.
Okay.
This is just this. What is.
Well, because I mean, if you quantize gravity, you would kind of expect to quantize the scalar too.
Right. So
this is. The actual equation you want to have. Either classical or quantum on both sides.
Right. So this is why you can think about this. This is, I mean, people in cosmology, in early cosmology, think about this scalar field as the vacuum expectation value of the zero mode of the scalar field. And then you quantize perturbations on the top of that, and you see how they evolve. Nothing different from what is a standard in this.
But here you need a potential, right? So the validity of your equations is unclear. You need a scalar potential.
I need a scalar potential.
You right. Can't really be sure about the validity of the equations.
So you give me, I mean, the statement is that you give me those equations, with a potential, and this is what happens. This is my statement. And again, this is about phenomenology of those equations.
But near the bounds, you don't know whether these are valid.
In what sense they are not valid?
Well, there's no support for these equations.
First of all,
defined dependent potential. It's a conjecture that what you have for a free massless scalar can just be extended to a non-free scalar.
Regarding the effective equations, you mean? Right. But you will see that in the regime where really the quantum effects are valid, but potential plays no role. So if you want, you take just that bounds in which the bounds is kinetic dominated.
Well, you don't know that because that's based on your assumption that you can use these effective equations. If you want to test the assumption, you should go beyond this, whatever approximation you use to get these effective equations and check it. But your statement is based on these equations. You're not testing them. You're assuming that they are valid.
I mean, there are some assumptions, but not completely, because one can put the potential, one can see what is the contribution of the potential close to the quantum gravity regime, and one can check that it's completely negligible. So the statement here is that the geometry across the bounds is very well approximated by a scalar field without potential, and the potential will be important later on. But again, I don't want to become this talk about loop quantum cosmology, otherwise it will never.
But there are these assumptions.
Right. There are always assumptions.
So it depends on phi, these equations have not been derived.
That is true.
So it's not clear they are valid if they haven't been derived.
Okay, let me keep moving.
Yeah.
So just to give you a flavor of how this happened, what the pre-inflationary dynamics is. So this is just an example of evolution. So imagine that before the bounds, the inflaton field is oscillating around the minimum of the potential. Let me assume a quadratic potential for simplicity. But whenever you get close to the bounds, the Hubble rate is negative and large. And that is an anti-friction in your equation. This anti-friction is going to boost the inflaton field. So whenever you enter to the bounds, the kinetic energy of the inflaton field is going to be generically large. Then the inflaton field is going to go up in the potential, can go over this direction or this direction, doesn't matter, it's symmetric. And so it's kinetic dominated. After the bounds, H is large and negative, so the anti-friction becomes friction. So the inflaton field is going to be, the velocity is going to decrease rapidly until completely stops. So in this transition, kinetic energy becomes potential energy. After that, the inflaton field is going to roll down, and this is when inflation starts. So we have some pre-inflationary dynamics, a stop, and then a slow roll inflation will start, and at the end will end at the very end. So this is the kind of trajectories that we normally find in our simulations. Two important things to remember is that a dynamical trajectory, the scale factor and phi as a function of time, they are characterized, if you want, by a single parameter, because if you think at the bounds, the initial data at the bounds is 4, a dot, phi, and phi dot, but we are in a spatially flat Freeman Robinson Walker, so you can rescale a freely, the value of a is not really physical, a dot is 0 for any trajectory, and the energy density at the bounds is fixed, so phi and phi dot are related to each other. So if you give me the value of phi at the bounds, I have uniquely characterized a trajectory. And physically, this value of the inflaton field at the bounds, if it is exactly zero, or it is over here, or over here, is important because it will determine, and I want you to remember this, this value will determine how much expansion there is between the bounds at the end of inflation. If at the bounds the inflaton field has a larger value, the inflaton field will go farther up in the potential, and inflation will be longer, and you will have more expansion. If the inflaton field has small value at the bounds, you will have less expansion. So this value will control how much expansion we have between the bounds at the end of inflation. And this is a free parameter I have, and this is the only parameter I can play with in observations later on. So please keep in mind that I have that freedom.
If I think about a region of space, the bounds might happen at slightly different moments in different places. So would this induce gradients in the scalar field profile afterwards?
I mean, that is going beyond this scenario because what one is assuming here is homogeneity,
Because this makes a big difference in terms of getting inflation started or not.
Right. So here...
There's the recent numerical work where people look at non-homogeneous initial conditions
right.
and see that the onset of inflation is actually very sensitive to that.
Right, exactly. But this is beyond this. This is homogeneous.
You know whether the balance is synchronized over a region of space or not.
Right,
you know, and
right.
That's not automatic.
Right, but we are doing mini superspace as you were doing yesterday.
Right.
So from the beginning, our universe is homogeneous. So that would be going beyond this analysis. So we are assuming the bounce happens everywhere in the universe, or at least in our Hubble patch and beyond for a while. And if we are not analyzing this, you know, even in inflation, these questions were only analyzed recently.
Yes.
So
yes,
so it's a non-trivial question, and we are doing quantum gravity, quantum cosmology. So it's. So therefore, the picture that one has is that one has a pre-bounce contracting phase, then a bounce. The universe expands for a little while after the bounce, is pre-inflationary regime, and then inflation starts, and so on. And what we want to do is to mimic what people do in inflation. They start the evolution at the onset of inflation. They assume the initial data for perturbations at the background there. What we want to do is to go to the past, take initial data here, evolve with our equations across the bounds, and compute what are the initial conditions of inflation and what are the consequences. And we will see that, you know, that the evolution across the bounds will leave an imprint on the perturbations, and therefore this imprint can later on leave another imprint in the CMB. So let me start computing, talking about the power spectrum, the two-point function. So first of all, I need to tell you which equations are, you know, which equations perturbations satisfy. What are the equations that I'm going to use for perturbations evolving across the bounds? The zero-order guess is that the equations are going to be the same equations as we use in GR or in semiclassical gravity, but the background is going to be substituted by this bouncing background. But, you know, one has to justify that. That would be a guess. And just to tell you that that question has been analyzed in detail, you know, first by Abai, Kaminsky, Lewandowski, and then myself, Wilson, Nelson, William Nelson, and Ashegar. And the final answer is that, yes, at zero order, that is true, but there are also some quantum corrections. So at zero order, that initial guess is true. Perturbations satisfy equations which are very similar or identical to the GR equations, but the background functions know about the bounds. But again, there are quantum corrections that one can add. This is a whole different talk I would like to give, but I don't have time today. So just I want to tell you.
Question,
that.
Do you claim that these perturbations are covariant?
Yes.
But that has not been shown, right?
That has been shown. I will go over that. Or they satisfy covariant equations.
Covariant in which sense? Taking into account the modified background evolution.
Yes.
That must be gauged. You can't change the background equations and not affect the perturbation. I mean, the perturbation equations consistency relies on the background. The Einstein equations being satisfied with the Friedman equation. So since you change the Friedman equation, then perturbation equations would be different in different gauges.
But you can find gauge invariant variables and talk about... Of course.
You can gauge fix and
right,
stick to one gauge.
Right, I agree. Right.
All right, but if I gauge fix to a different gauge, I would have different equations, but physically different.
And if you modify your background evolution, your gauge transformations are modified too, but the gauge invariant variables you use are just classical. So there's a tangent.
I think this is all being done at the level of some. The way this is done is we actually look at the phase space and of the relativity, the equations are classically, the equations are the same as the equations of the relativity for the regions. One goes to gauge invariant variables, and the debate is whether one should go to gauge invariant variables or should not go to gauge. So one goes to the gauge invariant variables, write down the field equations.
Which gauge invariant variables?
That's
Newtonian gauge. It's just gauge fixed. The use of the terminology gauge
invariant.
Well, the only
kind of
sacrifice. Yeah, those are gauge fixed.
No.
This is an old debate, but, right. But you can get different equations in different gauges. You agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. But then we can just look at the gauge invariant quantities, such as the curvature perturbation, because the background is conformally flat.
This is a gauge fixed quantity. Curvature perturbation means the Ricci scale on the
wild curvature perturbation. Gauge invariant, this space time.
For
tensor for example.
Well, sure, you could. That's true. They're less subject to.
They're not subject to that at all, because you just look at the wild. Okay, we'll talk about the
principle. You need to do nonlinear correction to those too. And then you will get into gauge issues.
It's an old debate, and I think
it's an old debate.
But it's a nice one, so we should. So just tell me, just let me tell you what we obtain. Again, we go before the bounds or at the bounds. When I will mention that later on. Before the bounds, where all the modes that we are interested on are inside the curvature radius, you choose an adiabatic initial state. We choose a value of 5 bounds to do the plots. This is done with a quadratic potential for the mass that is coming from the Planck normalization. And we evolve and we compute the power spectrum at the end of inflation. And this is what we obtain for a scalar and tensor modes. The two plots are very similar, so let me just focus on one of them. So this is the power spectrum, a scalar as a function of the wave number. Discrete points are the numerical result for concrete values of k, and the black line is the average. So the first thing that we see is that at very large k, the power spectrum goes to the scale invariant inflationary result, exactly the same result as in inflation. So no corrections from the bounds at large k. And this is expected because, you know, very ultraviolet modes, they are, you know, they are so ultraviolet that they are unable to fill the bounds. At the bounds, you know, they are much more energetic than the curvature, so they don't fill the bounds and
Surely they feel Planckian effects. I mean, it's quite. If you're doing loop quantum gravity, surely you have corrections on Planck length. But you're saying that the high K modes don't see any of
the high K modes in our approach doesn't see anything. The corrections.
How can you explain that? I can't possibly have a sub-Planckian mode not seeing any effect of the quantization
but
of space time.
It's not necessarily sub-Planckian.
Oh, it is.
Completely.
It must be. If it's going to be observable. It must be sub-Planckian before the inflation.
I mean, close to the bounds, the wavelength is of the order of the Planck.
It should be the duration of inflation so that they are not transplanted. I mean, they assume the smallest possible amount of inflation.
Well, it's barely sub-Planckian.
Yeah,
but even then, the large K modes is still
sure. By definition of large K.
So you don't handle the large K.
So we don't have super rocks, so we just truncate there.
You cut it off at the Planck length?
No, we don't cut it over. But we just consider wavelengths of interest. I mean, they go beyond, and this is all what I need for doing this plot.
So the statement is basically that these modes are actually wavelengths, as you say. They're smaller than the curvature radius.
I'm worried about the Planck
length.
They're smaller than the Planck length.
But the thing is that it's all within
bounds.
At the bounds.
So the statement is that. After which you continue again. Because it has to do with the area spectrum, which is exponentially crowded. So the wavelengths have to do with this distance between the crowding of the area spectrum up here. And so I think we should again discuss this in detail.
Do you evolve them from before the bounds?
Yes, or before the bounds, you give initial data for modes, vacuum, adiabatic vacuum, initial data before the bounds.
In what state do you put them before the bounds?
In one of the adiabatic vacuum, we have tried with several, but doesn't matter too much because, I mean, I will mention something else later on that I did recently. But what I did here, you go far enough into the past, in which all the modes are well inside the curvature radius, So the all adiabatic vacua give you very similar results. I have tried with different, and the power spectrum is almost insensitive to which fourth order adiabatic vacuum you choose to do the calculation.
And on the right, do the points all lie on this line, or you?
Say it again.
But you don't have points on the right. So to the right of one, of k equals one.
Here.
Do the points lie?
Right,
on the black
line? All them are behind the black line. So this oscillation, the amplitude of oscillation decreases, and you just get the black line. So the statement is that modes which are more ultraviolet than the curvature at the bounds, they don't feel the bounds, and they reach inflation in the bounds that is vacuum. So for them, there is no correction coming from the bounds. You just recover a standard inflationary result. More infrared modes, lower K, they feel the bounds, they are excited when they evolve across the bounds, and you reach inflation in an excited state over the bounds that is vacuum. And for them, you have all these contributions. So this contribution is coming from the evolution across the bounds, the fact that modes feel the curvature when they evolve across the bounds.
So your initial hypersurface where you initiate the bunch of Davies vacuum, how does the mode, how do you reconcile the fact that this mode is not common, it's not right, it has to persist through that vacuum state, because that mode was created prior to the bunch of Davies state, right?
So you consider a Fourier mode in the before the bands when the universe is contracting. Mm-hmm. So you have all your Fourier modes. You choose a quantum state for them. You say, OK, they are in this adiabatic vacuum. And then you plug in the equations, and you evolve them across the bounds. And you see, and then you see what is the evolution and at the and the final result at the onset of inflation, if you want. And you compare with the Banks-Davis at that time. What you get is not the Banks-Davis for every mode. It's the Banks-Davis only for very large or sufficiently large case. And for
so
more.
Stefan, you also worry about the fact that the wavelength at the bounds is much smaller than the complex.
Yes.
It's the same worry than the opposite.
I just don't have the intuition.
It is counterintuitive,
yeah. The question is, are quantum gravity corrections included in the mode equation? Or is it just the background? Or is it just the usual perturbation equations in the modified background?
So the statement is that the full quantum gravity in the sense of, you know, we don't have a quantum
gravity, so we only have elements of full quantum
gravity. So it's just the usual perturbation equations.
No. So therefore the statement is that there is of course a wave function here that he is specifying. And then for the background. And also there's a wave function that is specifying for the perturbations. And this perturbations are propagating on that particular background. Now, this is a wave function just for the homogeneous thing.
So we are worried about the equation which the perturbations satisfy. And the question is, for these waves for which the wave number, the bounds, is much larger than the Planck wave number, is the equation, is it the same that one uses without quantum gravity?
Yes, it seems to be the Newtonian gauge equations where you just put in a different background. But the trouble is I can gauge fix in a different gauge and then I would get physically different results. So I think the amplification of the low K modes you're getting is probably, my guess, a consequence of the fact that you're changing the background equation,
mm-hmm.
right? And therefore my suspicion would be that this bump is actually gauge dependent.
But we have done it with gauge invariant variables?
These are gauge fixed. Newtonian gauge is a completely gauge fixed gauge.
We are not using Newtonian gauge.
You are. You're using Mukhanov variables, which are Newtonian gauge.
No, but they.
That's called Newtonian gauge, conformal Newtonian gauge.
But they are gauge invariant in the sense that.
Any gauge fixed gauge is gauge invariant. So Coulomb gauge, if I calculate in Coulomb gauge, the vector potential in Coulomb gauge is a gauge invariant quantity, because I always go to Coulomb gauge. So this is a misconception in the literature.
If I would like to add just the tensor force and look at the wide curvature. And then the question is this announcement there or not? And the statement is, yes, it is there.
So it's a scalar power spectrum.
I know, but
it's a scalar power
spectrum. I don't really just say that, but I'm just saying that.
Okay. He also has the other one, yeah.
Yeah, it is a scalar power spectrum.
And this is tensor power spectrum. We have both then. And people have tried in the community with different gauges and with different ways of fixing the of gauge invariant variables, and the result is the same.
Well, for the tensors, it would be.
And for a scalar, it would be.
So can you show us those results? Say I choose synchronous gauge or any other gauge, and I completely gauge fix it in some way.
So for instance, I have done it with this Mukhanov variable,
yep.
This gauge invariant quantity, which
Italian
is
gauge.
We should discuss that because I think it's gauge invariant.
You know the inventor of that term was Jim Bardeen. The inventor, he wrote the first paper, Gauge Invariant Cosmological Perturbations. And you know also that he retracted the name in a later paper and he said this was a misconception. In fact, it's just gauge fixed.
Yeah, maybe we can discuss that.
We can discuss
more,
it.
More
yeah.
Okay.
So can I mean, to
my understanding is that they are gauge invariant in a precise sense, so maybe we can
see. In the same sense that
the CMB power spectrum, we can all agree that that's a gauge invariant observable.
No, we can't.
Yes, we can.
Not in this theory.
This is not, why? It's a CMB, that's an observable. How is that not gauge invariant?
The point is the equations being used
yeah.
to calculate the perturbations are not the Einstein equation.
That doesn't matter. If you have an observable based on a metric, I don't understand.
Oh, so you say I could
how
just...
How about the CMB power spectrum? How is that not a gauge invariant thing?
That's not where the gauge...
I understand.
Comes from.
I understand,
the gauge.
But if this thing gives rise to an observable effect, then it's real.
So
why is that controversial?
It's very controversial. I mean, if I allow any function, if I allow the scale factor of the universe to be any function I wish, right, and I then compute the gravitational waves in that background, or actually the scalar perturbations in that A of T, there is no guarantee the result is meaningful.
Sorry,
it's you because you didn't use the right equations for the background. I mean, the Einstein equations are gauge invariant as a whole. If I then come and stick in, for example, people who did variable speed of light, looked for C in the equation and replace C with C of T. That is not a gauge invariant procedure. And the results were meaningless as a consequence.
That's fine.
No. So you're worried about given a metric, how do I calculate the CMB? That is not the problem. The problem is where did you get the metric from? Did you get it from some equations which were covariant? And if you didn't, then you can't claim the result is gauge invariant.
It's a question of whether it's a covariant prediction or not a covariant prediction.
Yeah.
I should say I agree with Neil. No, but I agree with the point. Because this point has kept coming up in the past couple of days. And you cannot just arbitrarily change Friedmann equations and equations perturbation of the same.
You know, I really do that, and I agree that you're taking a background. So the way it's done is that really there is a background metric, and there's a perturbation, so not pattern, background wave function, and a wave, that's a product of the wave function of the perturbation. Then there is a Hamiltonian operator which acts on the whole thing. So the system consists of Friedmann-Lemaître-Roberson-Walker background together with perturbations. This is a truncation, and of course one can just say that it's not what one should be doing, that's fine. But that's what one does. And then there's a quantum equation that one is writing down for this thing. And then the statement is that the one is actually then solving for this quantum equation. And then the question is then is if in fact the assumption that is made is that the back reaction of the perturbations on the background wave function is negligible. In that case, then, the statement would be that you can actually calculate, under that assumption, you can calculate this power spectrum. And now your whole question is, well, but if I go back and if I look at what is, I got a background metric, which is in some regime, is not satisfying Einstein's equations. And I'm looking at some perturbation equations on that.
Yes.
And you're saying that because the background metric is not satisfying Einstein's equation, why is this consistent? So the real calculation would be to take, as I was saying before, this like Lagrangian, which has infinitely many terms, and actually show that, get the perturbation equations from there,
right.
That would have, and then and do this calculation.
Sure.
So the only short form that I know how to do that
right.
is to, of course, calculate something for scalar perturbations, but also calculate for tensor perturbations.
Right.
And then for tensor perturbations, go to wild curvature, which is gauge invariant, and see if, in fact, the results disappear or they don't disappear. So So that is a level at which the whole calculation is at the moment. It's true that you can be much more improved by actually, what is lacking is the fundamental equations that you would like to linearize. Now one can get those equations, one can just say, well, I just do these modifications and this is what happens. And I personally find that that is not as satisfactory as really.
I mean, just to say it more strongly, if you took your metric, the background and the perturbations, and you calculate d mu, g mu nu, you know, the divergence of the Einstein tensor, it will not be zero. The Bianchi identity will not be satisfied.
But
even at linear order.
Even at linear order.
But as Abai explained, the way this is done, I mean, this is what I haven't explained because I wanted to focus more on what is coming on.
No, it's fine. I think we understand what you did. It's a fine thing to do in the absence of anything better. And so, it's fine. Don't worry.
Well,
be
another
happy.
Approach, so Alagher said there's a Hamiltonian operator, but in other approaches one has tried to actually construct a Hamiltonian constraint in an effective theory, which will tell you how these gauge transformations work. And the only thing to make this work with this kind of background modification is if you have signature change.
But
no. I mean, there are all kinds of assumptions that go into
right.
that conclusion. So I think maybe...
No, the way I stated it, you go to an effective Hamiltonian constraint, you try to modify it in such a way that you get that kind of modification in the background. The only consistent models that have been constructed
what is
have signature
kind of
change. The modification that he uses in his modified background equation. That's, I think, what everyone agrees on. The background could be modified like this. And you have to reproduce something which extends this consistently to inhomogeneity.
Right, so I disagree that leads to something. I mean, these are interesting
intellectual questions. It leads to signature change, but the only consistent models which have been found so far have signature change. That doesn't mean that there are more contrived versions which might avoid signature change, but we don't know any.
The word contrived depends on your aesthetics. And so, what you say is that this more contrived version might be less contrived compared to what is actually.
Right, but we don't know any such version. That's the point.
It should be done. There's no question. So, but first of all, even these initial conditions could be stated at the end of your what you call the signature change feature. So at the onset of the Lorentz signature. So these conditions
don't
are not stated then.
Sorry? You don't have any bounds phase at all.
Oh, yeah. You could just state that. These initial conditions. So you just consider that. Okay. And you give your initial conditions for the perturbations at that state, which is also in the Planck regime, but not at the bounds. Fine. And the statement is that these results are not changed.
And these results are not about the bounds at all, if you can just remove it.
They're about the quantum geometry.
They're about the quantum geometry in the Planck regime. You're right. They're not sensitively tied to the bounds. They're about the quantum geometry that is coming in the Planck regime. That's what. So, in fact, there's another robustness that should be emphasized.
Well, then it's a weak result. Then it's just about choosing your initial state in some way. And
No, the background quantum geometry is important. The one that you're using.
You know that I'm going to disagree on that. Because there are toy models of bouncing cosmologies, for example. So the ones that Ifu Tsai worked on, where you have a bounce just constructed with some phantom matter, and then give rise to a short period of inflation, and then you have a lot of the same predictions. So in the sense that that's, when you say that the predictions that differ from standard inflation.
No, there is a particular scale that comes up here, which is the LQC scale. That would not be there, or that, I agree that there is a phenomenological model, you could choose that scale, the particular scale. So where exactly are we going to have departures from standard prediction? Is an adjustable parameter there. Here it is given by quantum geometry.
Well, here it was also, like you in your slide, you had given an initial velocity of the field at the bounce point. Isn't that what you had?
You have some small velocity because you choose.
Right, that's the parameter. That's the parameter that's given. That parameter is there. It is obviously there in the ad hoc models as well.
No, I don't think that parameter changes. I will explain that, but I don't think that parameter changes.
No, because if you if you have a huge velocity at the bounce point, then you have a long period of inflation.
No, it's the other way. So.
Okay, but anyway, there's this free parameter in these toy models, and there's a free parameter here. And where the corrections take over depends on a free parameter.
So, right, so this is what I was going to explain right now. So this is a very interesting discussion. We should keep them in the discussion session. And I mean, it's nice having some discussions, but that, you know, otherwise I will not be able to finish my talk. So here there are different scales. There is the scale at which the power spectrum departures from a scale invariant. This is the scale at which modes start filling this quantum geometry. And this is a scale given by the Ricci scalar, the scalar curvature in the bounds region, at the bounds. So modes which are more ultraviolet don't feel that. Modes, you know, in a simple way, modes which are more infrared feel that. So this is the scale that separates that. So now the key question here is which is the window in this k-axis that we can see in the CMB? Is that window here, here, or here? That depends on this parameter. That depends on these phi bounds. What is the value of the influence field at the bounds? Or in other words, that depends on how much expansion there is between the bounds and the end of inflation. If there is a lot of expansion between the bounds at the end of inflation, then all these effects are shifted to super Hubble scales and we can see nothing. We can just see this. If the amount of expansion is smaller, then we may see this, which is obviously in contradiction with observations. If the amount of expansion is in the middle, we can see something like what I have put in here, in which these corrections are only located in the large, in the k, small k region, large angles in the sky. So this is our free parameter and the only free parameter that we can play with. This scale is fixed by the theory, and we can play with which is the window that we can see in the CMB. The black line is the average with some binning.
Yeah, exactly. How did you choose the binning? Because it looks to me, if you would just follow your data point here, like your points, you would have much more oscillation. So how did you choose?
There are more many points in the top than in the bottom. So we have played with the binning, and this line is completely insensitive to the binning, just because points accumulate quite a lot more in the top part than in the bottom. So, in summary, if we have a large value of this parameter, so a lot of expansion, then the predictions are indistinguishable from standard inflation. The effects from the bounds are redshifted too much, and we cannot see them. Then what one has is just an extension of the inflationary scenario, including a bounds, but with no new effects. However, if phi bounds is smaller, a smaller expansion, then we may have some corrections, and the corrections would appear at large angles in the sky with our approach. And the corrections, I want to go fast over this because I want to mention something else. The corrections would be this enhancement of power at low k, and I will mention something more about this in the next slide. You modify the spectral indices and runnings, as is obvious. There is a small reduction of tensor to scalar ratio, but it's quite small and only at large scales. And also the consistency relation between tensor to scalar ratio and tensor spectral index gets modified in this particular way. So there are these are the generic effects. So what people have done in the last year or two is to add robustness or just try to extend this scenario. For instance, considering different potentials, at Penn State, people consider the Starobinsky potential and the results are very similar. With ABAI, we have added some quantum fluctuations of the background geometry and the results are also very similar. We have tried different initial conditions, different adiabatic vacua, using the freedom that one has in quantum field theory in FRW, and the results are very similar. And we have also extended to anisotropic bounces, considering anisotropies, to see what happens. And there are other approaches for perturbations which are not exactly the same as we follow, and the results are also very, very, very similar. Just let me mention something, which is an idea that Abai and Brajesh Gupta wrote recently. You know, what they did was to give initial data at the bounds rather than in the past, and use some extra physical principle to choose some preferred initial data for perturbations. They were using you know, what they call the quantum generalization of the wild curvature hypothesis by Penrose. And that, you know, with a, in a sophisticated manner, chooses for you an initial state for perturbations. That state has some suppression at a small k rather than amplification. So just keep in mind that there are other ideas in the market in which the power spectrum is suppressed rather than enhanced. But if I go to the past, I choose an obvious adiabatic vacuum, I find enhancement. This is what I find. So this is for the power spectrum, and the message here was just to tell you that you know, if you have a bounce before inflation, you may find some corrections in your power spectrum coming from the at large angles, a small k. But I always felt that, you know, that we have to go beyond the power spectrum and we have to study non-Gaussianity. And you know, non-Gaussianity has to do with the three-point function of these comoving curvature perturbations. Because in a Gaussian theory, they are zero, so they are called non-Gaussianity. And the motivation for me is, first of all, because we have observational constraints on non-Gaussianity. We don't see many non-Gaussianities in the CMB. And you know, one has the intuition that, you know, to compute three-point functions, you need self-interactions between perturbations. And self-interactions are mediated by gravity. And gravity in the quantum regime, near the Planck regime, is very strong. So you may think that non-Gaussianities are going to be boosted a lot because of the bounds, and you may find contradiction with observations. So in order to claim consistency, I thought that, you know, it's quite important to go and compute non-Gaussianity. And also because we may find some new observational effects. And to compute non-Gaussianity, what we need is to go beyond linear perturbation theory, so expand Einstein action to third order and repeat all this approach. The calculation is hard. In inflation, it was done by Maldacena not too long ago. And in inflation, it's even simpler because you have the slow-roll approximation. And the slow-roll approximation simplifies a lot the calculation. At the bounds, you don't have a slow-roll approximation, and you have to face all the difficulties.
So why would you use the Einstein action at the bounds?
Say?
Why would you use the Einstein action?
Start from the action. You repeat the procedure that we did, but now you go to next order in perturbations. So it's just what I did before, but going to higher order in perturbations. Maldacena did it with a mixture of Lagrangian and Hamiltonian techniques, but to repeat our approach, I need the full Hamiltonian phase space formulation. So what I had to do is to repeat what Maldacena did, but now in a full phase space language, without any slow-roll approximation that can help me. And there is a long calculation, you know, because of the discussion, I don't have much time, so let me just rush a little bit. So we start phase space variables, scalar field. This is just classical so far. This is just the beginning. Scalar field, conjugate momenta, metric, and three metric, and conjugate momenta. We expand around Friedman, Robertson, Walker, as usual. You define you expand in scalar, vector, tensors, modes. I want to focus on scalars, so we have 3 degrees of freedom. 2 of them are pure gauge, so I have to choose gauge invariant variables or fix the gauge, and we will discuss later on if that is the same or not. And you know, it really doesn't matter for the at the end of the day. So just to compare with what people do in inflation, I want to fix the gauge in the same way, the same gauge that they use, so I can compare. And then there is a strategy to fix the gauge, which is a standard. So let me just skip this because it is a standard thing. You fix the gauge and you go to the Hamiltonian to third order. The second order piece is just give you the free evolution of perturbations. Sorry, I am choosing a gauge in which phi 1 and phi 2 are zero, and all the degrees of freedom are in the scalar field. So therefore, the second order Hamiltonian is just a Hamiltonian for delta phi and the conjugate momenta. And this gives you a equation of motion, which is a Klein-Gordon equation with a potential. And the potential is just made of background functions. And the introton potential and its derivatives. And the next piece is this monster, which is the third order Hamiltonian. It's cubic in perturbations. I don't want to enter into details. I just show this to you, you know. So I can tell you how ugly it is. In inflation, because you have a slow roll approximation, most of these terms are subleading in a slow roll, and normally only one clean term has to be considered. Now I don't have a slow roll, I have to consider all of them. And this is for delta psi, for these perturbations. At the end of inflation, what I want to do is to translate the three-point function from delta phi to these commoving curvature perturbations, because these guys are the ones that are time-independent after inflation. And these guys are the ones that allow me to connect physics of inflation with later on physics. So I'm going to compute with delta phi, and at the end translate to the commoving curvature perturbations. And this is the dictionary. R has a linear term and a quadratic term in delta phi, and other terms which are unimportant at the end of inflation. So this is the important part. So what I have to do now is to compute the three-point correlation function of curvature perturbations, of this R. So the three-point function of this guy is going to have contributions from the three-point function of this guy, from the four-point function of this guy, because this from the five, six, etc. So you just expand, and you have three-point function here, four-point function here, and then subleading terms. So this is what I have to compute, and you just use the interaction picture in quantum field theory, in which operators evolve with the free Hamiltonian, the state evolve with the interaction Hamiltonian, this third-order Hamiltonian. You expand, and you do just what you do in quantum field theory. You just do the standard calculation that people do in quantum field theory, and you can compute this three-point function. And this three-point function, as you may know, it is normally characterized by a dimensionless parameter. It has dimensions of power spectrum square, so you just factorize two powers of power spectrum, and this is what you use to characterize the size of this non-Gaussianity. So what we have done is to compute this parameter, starting again the evolution before the bounds, across the bounds, and until the end of inflation, and see what happens. And let me show you the results. First of all, for when k1 is equal to k2 and is equal to k3 and is equal to k as a function of k, and this is what you obtain. So essentially, it has the same pattern than the power spectrum. For large k, you just recover the inflationary result. For a smaller k, you have this. I mean, first of all, you have oscillations, which are much larger than for the power spectrum. They are huge oscillations. And the shape of this oscillation, if you take the absolute value, has this exponential growth. So non-Gaussianity grow a lot, FNL grow a lot for modes that are influenced by the bands. And we reach values of the order of 10 to the 3 when the inflationary result is of the order of 10 to the minus 2. So there is a huge enhancement of non-Gaussianity from the bounds, as one could expect, because you know gravity is very strong at the bounds. For other configurations, we have the same. I just show you here FNL, remember, depends on K1, K2, and K3. I just choose this configuration, K1 equal to K2, and K3 100 times smaller as a function of K1, and you get something very similar. So the message that I want to communicate, the main feature here is that A, FNL is oscillatory. Second, you have this exponential growth. And third, that non-Gaussianity are more sensitive to the bounds than the power spectrum, in the sense that there are some cases for which the power spectrum doesn't fill the bounds, there is no enhancement, but FNL is very large. So the three-point function fills more the bounds than the two-point function itself. So there are some modes for which the power spectrum is just the standard Banach Davis power spectrum, but the non-Gaussianity are much larger. And to me, that is not surprising because, generically, non-Gaussianities are much more sensitive to any modification you do in the theory. This is why people were so interested in non-Gaussianity, because they tell us much more about the physics than what the power spectrum can do for you. Also, we have studied the shape of the, what people call the shape, for which configurations of K1, K2, and K3 FNL is larger, and, just tell you that happens for a squeeze, but not too squeeze configurations. But that is not very important for this talk. And what I want to do now is tell you, if we can understand part of this analytically, because this was a numerical result, because analytical expressions are out of reach. So what is this enhancement coming from? I found a very simple argument to at least understand where that can be coming from. And the argument is the following. The tripping function, at the end of the day, comes from a time interval of the interaction Hamiltonian with three field operators. And this time interval, you know, is in eta prime, so eta prime is here, so these three operators go outside. So this time interval is an interval of three mode functions. So these are intervals of this type, interval in time of, you know, three oscillatory functions for k1, k2, and k3, they oscillate a lot, and some prefactor, which is made of background functions. And the statement is, you know, can we estimate what is the growth of that interval? And to do it, we can go again to the Cauchy's theorem and asymptotic techniques. And they tell us that this interval is dominated by the pole with the smallest imaginary part in this interval. And it happens that if you go over that, you realize that that pole is coming from the scale factor. The scale factor at the bounds has a minimum. So the scale factor at the bounds can be expanded like this and truncated here. You know, a plus second derivative, first derivative is zero. And you can convince yourself that there is a pole whenever eta is an imaginary pole, is given by eta is the root square of, you know, this divided by this. So this is the poles that one has. And this happens to be precisely this new scale, because this is precisely the Ricci scalar at the bounds. A prime prime over A is precisely, with our conventions, is precisely the Ricci scalar. So this parameter is precisely this new scale that the bounds is introducing for you. So now you close the contour of the integration above, so only the plus contributes. And the conclusion of this very simple argument is that the integral should behave, at least for large k, as a negative exponential of the sum of k's divided by this new scale. So that is really the pole of this scale factor, where it is really telling you what is the exponential growth. And if you go to numerics and you plot that for different configurations of k1, k2, and k3, you obtain that, you know, this argument agrees completely with the numerics. So the statement here is that, you know, this argument is very simple. It involves very crude approximations, but it seems to capture where this growth is coming from. So the statement is that this growth is coming from this behavior of the scale factor at the bounds. And this new scale is what is telling you that FNL is going to grow exponentially when you go to a smaller case.
It looks like a suppression factor. It looks like a suppression factor. It's e to the minus. Something.
Right, so it grows. I mean, I say grow, but it grows when you go to a smaller case.
But the maximum is 1. So if k equals 0, its maximum is 1.
But then you have a prefactor in front of it, so that just tells...
So the prefactor also involves the k, the special k?
It may involve the special k. So as I said, this is a very crude, a very simple approximation. You know, you have to integrate this huge Hamiltonian with these three modes. So this was just trying to understand if this growth is just, you know, is just.
But at the end of the day, if you have a typical inflation duration which is quite high, you still have FNL equals zero in the observable part of the spectrum.
Right. So I go over that.
Because I mean, naively. Is it correct or not if I say naively that modes only decouple at the linear order, right? So at non-linear order, you could have some hope that super horizon effects could be seen within the Hubble sphere.
I will go over that. This is precisely the goal of my argument. So thank you for. So what about observational constraints? So we have observational constraints from Planck, and they tell us that for a scale invariant FNL is an FNL in which if you rescale the 3k simultaneously, doesn't change, or scales appropriately, so doesn't change for FNL, for the Tobias spectrum. Does. So in that case, for a scale invariant FNL, the constraints are more or less FNL is more than 10 for large L, and the error bars grows as 1 over L, so they grow for a small L just because of cosmic variance. But our FNL is not scale invariant at all, because we have this new scale and FNL decreases very abruptly for larger k. So the constraints are much weaker for the type of FNL that we have. And in particular, it is allowed by observations that, you know, this growth that I was showing before, this growth of FNL happens for the lowest multiples in the sky. So remember that, you know, I can always avoid any observational constraint if I use a huge five bounds, huge amount of expansion, these effects will be redshifted, and we will see nothing. So I can always put, you know, the new effects in the scale that I want. I have that freedom. I don't have any other freedom, but I have that freedom to respect observational constraints. And the statement is that there are values of this amount of expansion for which, you know, the range of modes that we see start here and go over there. So for which, and this is, you know, in L space, this is like L equal 30, more or less, and this is L equal 1. So it is allowed for us to have this large enhancement of FNL only if this happens for L's quite small, at very, very large angles in the sky.
Actually, there's something which I don't understand qualitatively. I don't understand that the bounds should depend on the spectral, the bounds on FNL should depend on the spectral shape of FNL. Don't the bounds come from particular scales in the sky? So shouldn't the statement be that what is constrained is the value of FNL at a particular physical or a particular angle scale?
Right.
Is that what the idea is?
No, I think you're right. It's just that the problem is you want to, because the constraints are so weak or it's hard, if the value is as small as it is, you have to combine a lot of the scales to get them into a constraint.
Right, but we have numbers which are more than 100.
This is a theory, but in data you have to combine everything. That's, I mean, you could do that. It just bounds get much worse if you just do that 1k.
Well, but let's take a small range of k, one order of magnitude.
Yeah, I mean that can be that.
Are the bounds much weaker?
But I mean, I think there is a scientific squeeze limit that actually coupling between very large k and small because in theory you're coupling three different k's to each other. And that doesn't involve a single k, it involves two k's. So in fact, it's not a one-dimensional, it's a two-dimensional.
But, so again, you find that it's not the squeeze limit that gives the largest FNL?
The largest FNL happens for some squeezing, but not huge squeeze.
So in that case, that bound should be a bit less dependent.
I mean, that can be done. I mean, for every particular shape, you could fine-tune, I mean, design an analysis that is sensitive to that shape. I don't know if they've done it for this shape.
Then people have not done it because there are infinitely many shapes and they don't do it for every new one.
They don't do it for everything.
But you're right, they could do something like you know, this Shellar, Ferguson, and these people in Cambridge with these bases that they have to adapt there. So
let me ask you a question. So in toy models of bouncing cosmologies, specifically in the matter bounce scenario, there's almost a no-go theorem against getting small enough tensor to scalar ratio and small enough non-Gaussian angles. So when I say almost a no-go theorem, so in the framework that we studied, there is a no-go theorem. We only studied a certain. So can you get small enough FNL and small enough tensor to scalar ratio at the same time?
Yes, if I have this large enough amount of expansion between the bounds and the end of inflation, then my window of observation will be here, and the bounce is completely relevant. So I can always make the bounce irrelevant for observations if I wish. But that is not interesting for me. So I have a free parameter, and I see if there is a value of my free parameter, it's just one parameter, that can produce new effects at large scales in the CMB, which are compatible with observations.
It's worse than that, because if you push the observations over there, then all your calculations don't work, because your modes would be exponentially sub-Planckian.
At the bounds will be, right. And then we have to discuss what Abai was mentioning
right.
before, that we have this area spectrum, how many degrees of freedom one has at the Planck scale. Right.
That's right.
Right.
So it's not just the requirement to fit the observations. It's
right.
a theoretical model also.
Because you know, I brought this up because it's a challenge for bouncing as well. To get these observations right. Actually, the ekparotic scenario is one where you can avoid the problem because
the theoretical problems are equally severe.
Yes, I'm talking about it.
So the statement is basically that if you just assume that the discreteness of Planck Planck here is like harmonic oscillator, then all these problems have become very important. But because the discreteness is subtle in the sense that the area eigenvalues actually grow exponentially. Mm-hmm. It becomes much more subtle.
But the point is well taken. So the statement here is that, but you know, this large FNL constrains how much expansion I may have. So what if I'm saying that in order to avoid, you know, tension with the value of FNL, I could have my window of case that we can see starting from here. And I, you know, the window that I can see in the CMB is starting from here. So I can see some non-Gaussianity in the larger scales in the CMB. But if I do that, then my enhancement in the power spectrum is in super Hubble scales. So constraints in non-Gaussianity, in order, at least for the initial states I consider, the constraints in non-Gaussianity makes this enhancement to be must be in super Hubble scales. So otherwise I would violate, if I put the K minimum here, I will violate constraints on non-Gaussianity. So the best I can have with this initial state is a state which is power spectrum is the same as in inflation for large scales, but it is largely non-Gaussian for very large scales. And the non-Gaussianity are large, but they go fast to zero. And this is what we found. So this is kind of in agreement with the fact that, you know, in a bounds in which curvature is high, the self-interactions of scalar perturbations are very strong, and FNL grows a lot. So I should speed up.
Yeah.
They will blame everybody. So.
Yeah.
So, you know, just quickly, because this FNL is very large, one thing that should worry is perturbation theory. And this is a point that Clifford will raise on Monday, that, you know, if FNL is large, it's because the three-point function may be large, so what about the perturbative expansion? You know, self-interactions are very strong. Sorry. Apologize. Self-interaction seems to be very strong, so what about perturbative expansion? So what I have done very quickly is to compute the two-point function to higher order and see what are the contributions, you know, the corrections to the two-point function. So I just go to, again, interaction picture, I plug the Hamiltonian interaction, and then I have two-point functions given by the two-point function of delta phi, three-point function, four-point function, etc. And I can compute the corrections to the two-point function, and, you know, the two-point function is power spectrum plus now some quantum corrections to the power spectrum. And it is true that you know, self-interactions and FNL grows a lot, but this three-point function knows about FNL and two powers of the power spectrum. And the power spectrum is very small, it's 10 to the minus 8 and minus 9. So even though, for the three-point function, even though when FNL is large, remember, three-point function is FNL, power spectrum. Even if FNL is large, the three-point function is small, because the power spectrum, the amplitude of perturbations is small. And this precisely makes this quantity small compared to this. And you can see a numerical plot where the ratio is of the order 10 to the minus 6 of a smaller. So the statement is that perturbation theory is under control because the size, the power spectrum, the amplitude of perturbations is still very small, even though this FNL may grow. So we are in an intermediate regime in which FNL grows, but still perturbation theory is under control. So to summarize this part, the bounds close to the Planck scale can boost FNL in a strongly scale-dependent way. There is this exponential growth for a small case dictated by the new scale. It's okay with the standard inflation for large case, and perturbation theory is under control. And this is okay with observations if this non-Gaussianity only happened for large K. And if you give me three more minutes, I will go quickly about the last part of the talk, which is some new effects. I will go fast because this is really work in progress. So this is more an idea and some preliminary calculations in some nearby scenario. But I haven't finished the computations with this FNL. But I think the idea is interesting. It has to do with large scale anomalies. So I'm sure you have heard that the Planck WMAP and then Planck have seen some anomalies in the CMB at large scales. This is the Planck paper. They see mainly a power deficit at large angular scales, so less power at large scales than smaller scales. And they also see a dipolar asymmetry. They find that if you divide the CMB appropriately, there is more power in one hemisphere than in the other. So they have this dipolar asymmetry. And they say that, you know, that because they were observed by WMAP before and then by Planck, the case for anomalous features have been strengthened, and such anomalies have attracted attention in the community because they could be visible traces of physics beyond inflation, of fundamental physics beyond inflation. It is true that the statistics is very small, so it's just three sigmas, so they could be just a fluke and not have any physical origin. But because they have been observed by different teams, and you know, there is some hope that they are pointing out towards physics beyond inflation. And these anomalies, they have seen different ones, you know, hemispherical anomaly and the power suppression that they mentioned in the abstract. But inside the paper, they have more anomalies: this quadrupole octuple alignment, parity anomaly, etc., etc. And as I said, they are not very significant, but they may be there. And when I see all of them together, what they seem to me that to indicate, and to other people also, not only to me, is that they require some non-diagonal terms in the two-point function of angular of temperature fluctuations. Because these non-diagonal terms, A, give you correlations between different L's, that tells you that L equal 2 and L equal 3 are correlated. They are not correlated if you don't have this term. And also, you know, if these terms give you anisotropies in the CMB. So if you have some anisotropy, like hemispherical anomaly, you probably need something like this. So people have tried to put anisotropies in the models to see if they can explain that. But they are very, very peculiar anisotropies, because they are only at large scales in the CMB and not at the small scales. So whatever you do, better don't affect the small scales and only affect large scales. And it has been very difficult to find proposals that account for more than one, not even one of them completely satisfactorily. And recently it has emerged an idea in cosmology by many people, but to my opinion, Smith and Hui state this idea in a more sharp way, which is that you don't really need to break isotropy at the fundamental level to explain these anomalies. What they say is that large correlations can do the job for you. Large non-Gaussianity can do the job for you. And the reason is that we can, in the CMB, we just see a single realization of the primordial distribution. And of course, even if your primordial distribution is isotropic, a single realization is anisotropic. What Planck is observing is that the anisotropies that we see are much larger than what you expect from inflation alone. These people tell you that if you have large non-Gaussianity, a typical realization of a non-Gaussian spectrum shows bigger anisotropies than a Gaussian one. So having anisotropies could make these features just simply not anomalous. So the point is that you give me a model for non-Gaussianities, and I compute this modulation, you know, the effect that they produce, and I can see if I can explain these features or not. And the point is that it's very difficult to find a model of non-Gaussianity, you know, that only modifies large scales, not small scales, that produce a dipole, but doesn't produce a quadrupole. You know, my statement is that this non-Gaussianity from abounds have exactly the right shape. That the non-Gaussianity arising from abounds, when you have this new scale, have exactly the ingredients that you need to produce this kind of anomalies in the CMB. And I don't have time, but you know, one can compute what is, you know, the amplitude of the modulation that this non-Gaussianity produced in the power spectrum. I just expand them in an additional multiple, so you have a monopolar modulation to the power spectrum for L equal 0, dipolar modulation for L equal 1, etc. And this amplitude may depend on the scale that you are observing. So you may have a dipolar modulation only for small L's and not for large L's. So this is a parameter, and what I have done is to compute this parameter with the non-Gaussianity arising from the bands. And what you obtain is something that has exactly the required shape to explain this kind of anomalies together. I mean, not one of them. Because the monopolar modulation can produce amplification or suppression. So with this modulation, half of the realizations of our universe could have suppression. That means that the anomaly is not an anomaly anymore, because half of your CMBs would show a suppression. This is the dipolar modulation, which is a scale invariant only for small L's and having a size which is of the order of magnitude that we are observing. Quadrupole, very small, so you will not see any quadrupole. Octuple, even smaller. So the pattern, not only the pattern, but also the shape and the size is very much in agreement with this what you need for this kind of analysis. So again, this is work in progress, so I don't want to claim anything yet, but just to state the point that the shape of this non-Gaussian is precisely what you need to modulate the power spectrum to account for this anomalies that Planck and WMAP are observing. And just to finish, I am way over time, so I will leave this plus. This is a summary of what I have said, and we can discuss more.